Accession number 13717, Lieutenant Colonel Charles G. Reel 4.
Lieutenant Colonel G, Reel 4. We were talking about the headquarters mess. One aspect I'd like to ask is your own servant.
I had a servant. I didn't spend much time with him because I was too busy. I was in the order room. But
do you remember his name?
No, I don't remember his name. I remember later in the war, but not then.
What did your servant do for you? I mean.
Well, I suppose he cleaned my buttons and boots and things and tidied my bed and was on tap for helping anybody. Used when we got to Ypres for taking loads up to the front line, like everybody else.
Now, since last time we met. You've thought of three episodes that happened before you were adjutant that
yes.
You'd like to tell us about.
One was a platoon attack onto a dell or in a dell where we could use live ammunition.
This is training.
Just me with the platoon, with the second in command was watching to criticize.
That's Crouch.
Yes. All I can remember about it is that I thought it went more or less all right, but he was critical of one or two things, and he was, I thought, wrong. I thought I'd been trained. I did what I'd been taught at Oxford, and he'd probably never seen it at all. And so he notched one more thing against me. That
do you remember what you were supposed to have done wrong?
No, I can't remember what I was supposed to have done wrong.
And that was the first
one? The next one I can remember. There was a very big battalion attack.
Training again.
Training, with the corps commander there. And I got personally ticked off by him.
What was that for?
Well, as far as I remember, I was in the company, I was the right-hand platoon of the company, I think. At a certain stage, the company commander, who was not all that attractive, shouted at me that I was late or something or other. In any case, I was a bit cross, and there in front of me was an enormous band of old German wire. The Germans had retired, and the objective was beyond it, taped line or something like that. And there was this ruddy wire, and there were no holes to it. And I got to get there quickly, so I saw it was rusty and ran over it with a whole platoon without anyone falling in or getting caught, possibly a few scratches on my putties. Got to the taped line, which is the objective, and I knew we shouldn't go beyond it, but I had been told, don't go beyond it unless within 50 yards or something dominating you. You clear that and come back again, which I did exactly, so I knew I was right. And then I was sent for by the corps commander. I had to go to him. I remembered my brother saying on the Somme, corps commanders appeared with a huge telescope and looked at my Metz or some place by name and said, I'm still convinced that can be taken by frontal attack on Wednesday, 2,000 men or 20,000 men will again attack it. Same conditions as before, and it never was taken. It was the same conditions, applied the same result each time. So I wasn't very much in awe of a corps commander, but received a big ticking off for going beyond the tape line. I didn't argue because I knew it would be useless. I just received the ticking off.
Who was your corps commander?
I can't remember. Somewhere about then it was Hunter Weston, which I saw a number of times. And there was a joke about him. Three of our men met him on the road and they saw him coming and hid in the ditch. He came along and drew up his cavalcade, and your corps commander, Lieutenant General, so something, Hunter Weston, salutes the honour dead, and went on again. But that was the
What was his reputation?
Well, that I think, just nothing much. There's a lot of attacks, just repeating. The trouble, I think, really was that the army, and to some extent the Germans as well, had a sort of tradition that if people were shot, you filled their place, well, they'd get shot as well. If there's a machine gun shooting them. And that wasn't really seriously altered until the territorial camp I went to after the war. They adopted German tactics of not filling it up, but going, supporting success rather than filling up failure.
Did you think this at the time?
No.
So that you saw that after, when you were introduced to the new techniques?
Yes.
But in 1917 you wouldn't have been aware?
No, I didn't know. And
the third thing, you said?
The third thing was battalion sports. I can't remember the sports that year, but I know that all junior officers anyway went in for a mule race. And I can remember that. There were about 20 of us. All I can bareback the mules, they were drawn up, and we had a rope to hold. I don't think there were ropes around the neck, I think there was one rope that I held with two hands. And anyway, when we started, we had to go around a biggish circuit. When they said go, nothing happened at all. The mules were all stationary. And eventually an officer on my right, I think, leaned right over and kicked his mule very hard in the stomach. And he took a few steps quickly forward, threw him off, and a bang on the ground, and all the other mules turned the other way, and everybody was facing the wrong way, and absolute pandemonium. And the next thing I remember was chaos, and I didn't see it all, but my mule went off at great speed, being hit by various soldiers with sticks and things, diagonally off the course across open country. Great speed, and I was holding on, or balanced on, but it was going quite straight. Eventually got in a trench about 2 or 3 feet deep, an old fallen-in trench, and after going a bit, it decided to get rid of me. I remember at the end of the rope, being the full stretch, and hitting the ground an enormous bump. And I don't know whether I was knocked out or winded or anything. When I came to and realized I was alive and said, thank God that's over, a nice boy said, oh, so get up. I've caught your mule. You must have come a long way. And there's only one officer in front of you. So I got on the mule again. I was helped on and got the mule going at a fair speed to catch the one officer or something. Hundreds of yards ahead. Just as I got near him, the first mule that had given the trouble and thrown an officer had been caught, and the officer got back on. It was bolting for the transport lines, and mine followed it, going full speed in an open field. And then I saw ahead, this has been sudden camp, two angle irons sticking up, and the mule in front didn't see them, went straight for them. It saw them at the last minute, threw the officer into them, and he was very badly damaged, had to go to a hospital. But the mule went on straight away. Watching this, my mule got rid of me safely and went to the transport lines as well. And of course, people behind saw this happen and came up and helped me up and tended the damaged officer crashed into the transport lines. The next year, being captain and adjutant, I refused to go into the mule race.
Bradford
but the next year, it wasn't Bradford, the mules all started the same speed, quiet canter, and they went round and round and round and round in a straight line, two or three times. There was no race, nobody won, nobody lost. There was no amusement. I think they must have trained them to do it. It was a joke.
What else did the battalion sports consist of?
I don't remember then. The most amusing item from my point of view, was a boot race. People took their boots off and left them there and walked 100 yards away. And then on the word go, you ran and got your boots. And having got your boots, you ran back to the start or onto. When a man got to his boots, look at them all, smell them all. How he found which are his, I don't know. They must have known. Not mine, chucked them away, and some boots were spread all over the plain before the thing finished. And it was very, very funny to watch. And I'd be things like one, I remember, fancy dress. I didn't think it was possible. One person came a safety first, dressed entirely in toilet paper. And it was very funny indeed. And similar sorts of things. But it was very popular amusement after training in the morning.
Now, I've been reading the Bradford book you lent me, the reprint yes. of the book about him and his brothers, and there's just a few points I'd like to raise from yes. the book, having read it. The one thing was, did you ever see, he was known as a very brave man, obviously with a feast yes. and everything, did you ever see any doubts or nervousness or signs of stress and strain in him while
no.
you were with him?
No, no, I don't think ever. Don't think it was very much opportunity. No, he was completely calm. The word I was trying to get yesterday and didn't get his personality, I think. Any time in his presence, yeah, personality in any room. He was tall and good looking and very fit and assured.
Do you think he just didn't know what fear was, or do you think he just overcame
Oh, he
it?
Knew what fear was. There is one episode in the book when even Bradford was frightened. I think a person who didn't know what fear was, like Siegfried Sassoon, was useless. Have you read, there is a book in which he figures quite a bit. He had been very friendly with gamekeepers and things, and he didn't seem to know what fear was. But he was bombing down a trench, and he bombed so far, instead of reporting or going back, he read a book. But it took 500 men's lives to recapture that trench the next day. But he was so fearless that he was unreliable. He wasn't taken on a raid they did, a big raid. He wasn't taken on it as not being reliable.
But you didn't know so soon.
I don't notice that in Bradford.
But Bradford just controlled his fears.
Oh, yes.
Did you ever see him startled by shell fire or anything?
No, I don't think ever. And he taught us all to, as the book says, to get down and even if a shell landed 100 yards away.
So it wasn't bravado?
Oh, no, it wasn't bravado. It was teaching the men to save their lives, to live to fight. On one occasion, with me, a shell, I was lying down, and quite a distant shell, a piece of the shell hit my pack or my back and bounced off. I mean, that proves that it pays to lie down.
So he wasn't the sort of officer who'd stand up showing his courage?
Oh, no.
He'd get down with the rest of you?
Oh, yes, and would do it as example. But if it were necessary to... when people were frightened, he would stand, I think, to get them down. He would take risks to get the situation right.
So he'd only take risks, as far as you were concerned, to improve the men's morale?
Yes.
When it was necessary, absolutely.
Quite clearly, yes.
The other thing was, he comes across in the book as quite a religious man. Would you say that was so?
Some paper, I don't know if it was John Bull, talked about a religious fanatic commanding the battalion. The important thing I remember is we had, whenever a band could play it, the first and last verses of Abide With Me that I remember particularly, sometimes perhaps a whole hymn. The last verse ended with death, in life and death, O Lord, abide with me. So it was a very reputable reminder of possibility of death, and it really became a sort of habit. And it is now the army hymn. Whether it was the army hymn then, I don't know. The book says his favourite hymn.
He used to encourage the men to sing it. I mean, do you remember that?
As oh, yes.
The book, because some of these books are sort of romanticised a little, but did he actually encourage the men to sing a Bible?
Yes. Not the whole hymn, but these two verses to join into the band and to sing it if they weren't there.
What about in the line?
I doubt what they did in the line. I thought that was romanticising, but packets of them probably did. And there was one we had for a bit, one very religious officer who was very good with his platoon, and they liked the religion. And there was a Christmas card he sent of Christ appearing in the trenches or something.
What's his name? Do you remember?
I can't remember his name. But he was, I think as the book says, deeply religious and thought it would be helpful and was helpful to him. And Green
Battalion,
was the 9th Battalion, yes. Green Diamonds. And he was very keen on anything that would cheer the troops up. And I'm pretty certain that he... I know it happened in the battalion, that we were somewhere well out of the line, and near a railway line, and he let the men go to Amiens. All together, but by companies or something, without permission from above. Those that wanted to go could go, providing they were for some reason back that night and fit for the next day's work. And quite a lot went and got raped by their wives, and they got home. They had a girl in Amiens and so on. But I think they went by companies. When it was successful and nothing wrong, then got permission to do it. Other battalions did it, and we did it again.
Now, another thing you mentioned rather than the book was that there was a leave strike.
He tried to organise a strike against leave, so as to get the men's leave better. The men hadn't been out 2 years without leave. Officers got leave every 6 months and should have things on the boat, or there would have been more boats. And it went on for a long time. Hundreds of men had been 2 or 3 years without leave.
So what did he do? How did he, or what did Bradford do?
When he was on leave, get his sent on leave, when he went to register his medal, he, civilian clothes, his, and went to Hyde Park to get those Daily Mail and things like that, to get any men's leave. He failed. And then there's he put in this complaint, some complaint, to staff every day, and they just got in the habit of stopping it in the division. But it somehow got through. The divisional commander may have been on leave or something or other. It got through to a corps commander, and some big noise came down, absolutely furious. And I heard a lot of the row, because he made me find the letter he'd sent in, a copy of it, and it was, as the book said, a bit stark a criticism.
What had the letter said, do you remember?
I can't remember, except
what was the gist
that
of
men's
it?
Leave was scandalous, and the men were getting into a state of shell shock, and it was unfair, and officers would have less leave. Anything to get more leave for the men. But the main accusation was that the staff or the people, which were quite safe, got leave.
And what did...
Much
so
of.
He said that he gave the gist of... That was the gist of what...
Yes.
What happened at this interview? You were there, were
yes,
you?
Yes, I was there, because I came to the mess, to the order room, to the tent, I think, and said, find the copy of... I heard the... A man speaking to him very rudely and got a copy of the letter and handed it out to me. You think you're the only person that bothers about leave. I tell you what I do every day. I go in and say, Max, how's leave? Good, sir. And that's all. And Bretton went on arguing and arguing.
This was with the Corps Commander?
Corps Commander, I think. And we had then a huge notice in the camp was the order of leave. The men could see when they would go on leave, and looked through that. And eventually the corps commander said, well, that is a good idea, we'll get that done, every battalion. But I will try and get more, but nothing happened about it.
Did he actually refuse leave himself or encourage?
He tried to. He did refuse to go and got ordered to go to get his medal.
And then he went?
Yes.
And that's
and
when
he did take 4 days leave in Paris, so the book says. I don't remember that. A number of people, that's similar to the day in Amiens for the men.
Now, he was also very keen, according to the book that we both looked at, that the officers share the burdens of the men. It says that he encouraged them to carry packs when they were on route marches,
yes,
and to wear steel helmets when the men
did. There always was steel helmets when the men did. But when Colonel was on leave, and somebody from the Border Regiment came to act as Colonel while he was away, I couldn't persuade him to wear his steel hat. He wore his ordinary cap in training.
And the idea of that was to show the men that they should wear theirs, was it?
Oh, yes.
Were steel helmets unpopular then?
Yes, they were heavy and hot and so on, but they were obviously safe from head wounds.
You'd wear yours as well?
Yes. And the point of having hair cut, close, I had mine always cut close unless one was due to go to leave and miss an odd haircut, was when you wash your face, you wash your head. And the thing was clean. If you got a head wound and your hair was really dirty, you have to poison the wound. It was
so
efficiency for the war.
It was all practical.
Yes,
even
all practical. All to win the war.
Now, he also made you carry packs on route marches. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that, but...
Would you carry... I mean, do you remember it personally?
No, I don't remember.
So you wouldn't carry a pack?
I don't remember going on route march.
It's also mentioned that he was very careful about the sort of billets they got.
Oh, yes, everything. Everything was a men's care. But I think I had a bad company commander when I was in a company, because I don't remember him taking me around with the men or introducing me or anything. I don't think he worried, but Bradford knew all the men as far as was possible.
Now, another way of looking at things is to look at the daily routine. When you're adjutant, about what time would your day start? Let's look at it in the line first.
In the line? Well, I've been up, slept a bit of night, and there would be a sentry on. The first time I ever went into the line, the people were relieved, said that their headquarters sentry had been taken by the enemy in the night, which scared me a bit, because we were in the same place.
Where would your headquarters be? Do you see what I mean?
A few hundred yards behind the support. Would be a few hundred yards behind the front line. It wasn't very long.
You'd be in the support line, a few hundred
behind
yards.
The support line.
Behind the support line.
Yes.
So that was in turn behind the front line, of course.
Yes.
So several, 400 or 500 yards.
Oh,
back.
Yes.
And what would the headquarters consist of? I mean, what?
Nothing, just a piece of a trench.
Not a dugout?
No, occasionally a dugout. I think nearly always a piece of a trench. We didn't do dugouts. The Germans did.
If you had one, it would be just a captured German one, mostly.
Yes, so that's because the rest of them I captured.
And what would the headquarters consist of in the line? There'd be you and Bradford. And what about the
intelligence officer? A transport officer would visit with the transport at night. There was another officer who did oddments. But there were very few of us.
And would you have the same staff as when your company office, I mean, out of the line, we discussed that, but would you have
I'd have a clerk with me, in case there was clerking to do, which wouldn't be likely.
But not the sergeant?
No.
Just one clerk?
the sergeants would carry on with their forms and things that would have to go in.
Out of the line.
Out of the line.
So and they'd never go into the line.
Clerks that could reproduce orders and things for the companies if it, or answer letters.
So they'd be out of the line, the sergeants.
Yeah, they'd
the
be out of the line.
Company office would stay out of the line. It wouldn't move up when you moved into the line. So you'd start your day and...
I had very little to do in the line. Occasionally, because the colonel, after breakfast, went up to the men and spent...
What would you get for breakfast, usually?
I don't know.
Right.
But probably porridge or an egg or something.
And then you said the colonel went up to the line. Would you go with him?
No, I think it was a servant with him. His servant would be there. And he frequently didn't come back till summertime. He sort of lived with the men. He occasionally sent me with my servant to go round the line just to see what was what. And one particular time he came back and said such and such a portion of the line is having trouble because the Germans have been putting one or two shells on that, and there's a little bit of a forward post. And I told him exactly what to do. I think there's going to be a raid. Well, there was the raid, exactly as he prophesied. He sent me round the next day, and the men were absolutely astonished at what the colonel said. He prophesied exactly what the Germans would do and what we had to do, but we couldn't do it quite because someone got seriously wounded, and intending him, he didn't do something we were supposed to do. But absolutely, I said, oh, he always knows what's happening and he's always right. And
so when he went round, he'd just go round checking the line.
And talking to people.
And talking to, not just talking to his officers, his company officers.
Oh no, talking to the men. The men's by weight. And some men would talk well, and so they became sort of favourites. And they knew the colonel's mind more than the officers did. And so we sometimes got information from them as to what the colonel was planning or doing. But I remember early on getting a wire from that the enemy were massive, would attack opposite, and I said, shall I send that around to the company? He thought a bit, said, no, I've been around there, and I'm quite happy, the sentries are there, everything's all right, no panic at all. And of course, we weren't attacked.
Now, so he would really know most of the men by name?
Yes.
Literally, I mean,
literally, no, he'd know them by name,
sort of flannel,
and they would know him.
And so he'd do that almost all day?
All day.
And what would
normally,
you,
all day.
What would you be doing back at the headquarters?
Well, very little. Answering an odd one or two letters, taking one or two calls from back.
You'd have a signaller with you then, would you, a telephone?
Oh, it's a big telephone, and the intelligence officer would be training his intelligence staff of 12 or whatever it was.
And where would Crouch be, the second in command?
Oh, back at the transport.
So he didn't come up?
No.
So you'd be the one, you and the intelligence officer, and he'd be training his men, and you'd be the one nearest the phone and the signal?
Yes.
And what sort of messages would come up?
This one about the enemy preparing to attack, possibly something about letters that the sergeants would answer in the orderly room, but normally I think the rations, any problems about the rations coming up at night, whether they're coming up on mules or transport or whether to be